Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode number 19 of the Beer Pinions podcast. As always, I am Pat Berger from Kaiser Tiger and Patty Longs, and with me is Bruce.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
From the Chicago Beer Tours. Brew Tours.
Yeah.
I'm getting it right now, right?
Chicago Beer Experience.
Oh, I didn't get it right. But it got you an extra plug.
Yep. Thanks, man. Yeah. Hey there. You know, you type in beer tour, we'll show up at some point.
I'm sure. Yes. Yeah. Get your SEO working. I'm sure you guys come up first. We, as promised in the last podcast, we have a very special guest today. Legendary beer bar owner, Chicago legend, Mike Roper. Michael, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. This is fun.
You don't know. We've just started.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much.
Okay. The good news is no one's listening. So,
my dad is, actually, though.
Bruce's dad is listening, yes, and maybe a few other loved ones, you know, other than that. I just wanted to take this opportunity to kind of sit down and get a little bit of craft beer history from someone who has literally lived it, and 25 years at the Hop Leaflet this year. That is monumental in my mind. You know, we just did 10 years at Patty Long's, and I thought that was, you know, a milestone. But it's really nothing compared to 25 years, not just in a business, but especially our business, which is so fickle and crazy and trendy, and somehow you have managed to be above any scene or trends, and you're here.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing is that, you know, I started as a waiter in a bar in the early 70s. So, you know, my bar career actually it's starting to get close to 45 years.
Oh, wow.
It is a completely different business than when I started. I mean, it almost doesn't seem like I am in the same business that I started in. And you could even say that 25 years ago, that the changes are so dramatic that some of the things that I thought I learned over those years aren't even relevant anymore. You have to keep learning. I mean, you can't keep changing all the time, because the audience for craft beer is different. The audience for a neighborhood tavern is different. The distractions, the competition, the aesthetic, everything is very, very different. Probably half the people that I waited on when I started my career are dead. You know what I mean? Several generations of new tavern goers, beer drinkers have joined the scene since I started, and they, you know, their life experience is very different than mine or the customers that I was serving back, you know, over 40 years ago.
Yeah, go ahead, Bruce.
I was going to say, and just to give a little more color in case you're not aware, when I think of kind of beer bars in Chicago, there are two bars that I think of first, and I'm not the only one to do this, which is the Map Room and the Hop Leaf, which is, so I'm kind of nerding out right now, so thank you again for coming on, because when I moved to Chicago, those were and still are considered, I think, the most iconic of places. So
we both started the same year, too. I took over the former Clark Foster Liquors in February of 1992, and Laura Blassingame took over what is now the Map Room in October of 1992. So we're only months apart in opening.
Yeah, it's right. I was reading did a little research, and kind of your early days at the Hop Leaf I found really interesting. Something about serving Everclear in glasses when you took over, and particular movies being played.
we inherited an ethnic old man bar in a former Swedish neighborhood that was going through a big demographic change, and the beers and liquors and experience that those people wanted were, you know, really not what we were interested in. But for a little while, I didn't just buy this place, and instantly it's Hopleaf. It morphed into Hopleaf over about a year. And one of the things we had to do is we bought all of the stock that was in the place when we bought it. So we had cases of Everclear and Pina Colada Schnapps and Tall Boys of Old Style. And we had cases of really terrible wines, MD 2020 and Orange Smash and Nitrate, really fine wine.
Oh, yeah.
So I was not in the economic position to throw all that stuff out. I needed to sell it. So I sold it through with the customers that had been going to the bar for years. And we had kind of an uncomfortable era where I would run out of something that one or two of these old guys liked, and I wasn't going to reorder it and say, now I don't have any more Nitrate, so I'm sorry, we're not going to do that. And we're out of the little minis and half plastic half pints of Mohawk vodka. What do we do now?
I can relate. It was similar when we took over. We took over a kind of a legendary dive bar. It was called Lowry's.
Oh yeah.
It was there 70 years. Lori, of course, didn't leave us with much stock. He did leave us with a case of Malort.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I think
Malort before it was cool.
Before it was cool. And, I don't know if I would have ordered Malort right off the bat when Patty's open, but since we had that case, that's when, we were using it to fuck with people, Malort them, as we always do. And it's good Lori left that case, because one of the guys I Malorted was Sam Meckling, who now is the director of Malort. I don't know what his title is. Malort King, whatever Malort it is. King,
yeah, it's something that's not appropriate.
Right. But yeah, we had a little bit, probably more of a backlash than you did, because, Lori's was a really beloved neighborhood institution. And, I would have loved to have left at Lori's, but at the price he sold it to me, I couldn't. That's what I always told everyone. Like, I didn't close it. Lori did, If he would have, if he would have let me buy it for 50 grand, I could have left it just like this,
Yeah, right.
But, he didn't, and I couldn't.
I actually didn't pay very much for Clark Foster Liquors, because it was doing so poorly. And there was an interesting transition. The old Swede that owned it for, since 1952, he had sold it the year before to a observant Muslim from Pakistan, who, why this guy would buy a liquor store and a bar is beyond me. And of course, the place was doing badly before he bought it, and then after he bought it, it went into like economic collapse. The only thing that kept the doors open were the poker machines. The poker machines actually took in more revenue than the bar or the retail operation with packaged goods.
He was obviously paying out on those poker machines.
Oh, he was. And we took him out, pretty quickly afterwards, and there was a little bit of backlash about that, not just with the customers, but with the Serbian gangsters who own the poker machines.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Yeah.
But you know what? It was really funny, because after, I told them to take the machines out, these guys came in, and they were like really scary guys. And they asked me, whose poker machines are you putting in? And I was like, I think if I had said I was putting somebody else's machines in, they probably would have just killed me. But I said, we're not going to have poker machines in here anymore. And the guy had this thick accent. He goes, "Oh, you make gay bar." And I just said, yes, it's a gay bar, and we're not going to have poker machines anymore.
Just go, go with it. Yeah,
he was fine with it, as long as I wasn't putting anybody else's machines in,
right.
Everything was cool.
I think poker machines would do pretty well in gay bars.
Yeah, they probably do, but I just went along with him because...
They do well in every bar.
I would go along with anything that guy said.
Yeah. Whatever it took to, yeah.
What do you think is going on with neighborhood bars right now? Because I'm a little concerned. I don't see them playing the role that they've played in in people's lives that they used to. And I don't know if it's I don't know. You know, I don't know what these kids are into, but they certainly don't revolve around their lives around a bar like I did when I was 22, 23. I mean, I had a local and I went there every, it was the Map Room, by the way, but, you know, I went there every day just to say hi to my friends and see what was going on. And
that is a really sad thing that I think it's happening. It's one of the biggest sea changes that I see happening, that the neighborhood tavern is starting to become a little bit of a dinosaur. People, they are not tied to their neighborhoods the way they used to be. I mean, you know, the people that used to go into Clark Foster Liquors, they lived in the same neighborhood their parents did. Some of them, their grandparents lived there. They had cultural ties, be it, you know, an ethnic tie. You know, in our neighborhood, it was Swedes. Milwaukee Avenue was all the Poles. Puerto Rican neighborhoods, et cetera, are not... they're not as long, the commitment isn't as long to a neighborhood. People stay for a year or two and then they leave, and then they go to another neighborhood and they leave, and maybe they move to Portland, Oregon, or they move to LA or whatever. Because they are not tied so much to a place anymore, the neighborhood tavern is not as central to their lives. One other thing is that people used to depend on, like, the corner coffee shop or the corner bar for most, if not all, of their social interaction. Now, an awful lot of people, a lot of their social interaction is in front of their laptop, so they don't even go out as much anymore. And maybe they order some food from Grubhub, and they're not shopping in the neighborhood. There are all these great incidental activities in neighborhoods like ours that brought people into the bar. They'd go to a shoe store, or they'd go shop for groceries, and then, I think I'll go stop and have a beer over at the corner. Well, if people are buying all of their clothing and shoes and groceries and, you know, home decor and everything else online, they're not going out. And we've seen that in a big drop of day drinking.
It doesn't exist anymore.
We don't get the day drinking anymore because there's nobody on the sidewalks. You know, on Friday and Saturday, maybe, Sunday, maybe, but, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, there's nobody on the streets.
It also used to be acceptable to have a drink at lunch. You know, if you come back to pretty much any job now and they smell alcohol on your breath,
you're gone.
You know, whereas it used to be like, hey, I'm going out to lunch, I'm gonna have a few pops, and come back, I'll be a little refreshed.
Yeah,
and
gonna be in a good mood.
Afternoon in the office will go by a lot quicker.
Yeah,
but that doesn't exist anymore. When we had a construction project by the bar back in the day, you were happy because you were like, I got a nice crew coming in for lunch, and these guys would come in and, they'd slam six beers in, half an hour. They never ate anything. And you got to know them all by the time, you were sad when the construction project was over. Now, those guys can't even look your way, much less come in and have a beer at lunch. They're fired in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think, I think that that role that the American Urban Tavern had, which was not unlike the role that the British pub had in the UK, is waning everywhere. I mean, you've been reading probably about how many pubs are closing in the UK these days.
Yeah,
I mean,
Ireland is the same thing.
It's really shocking. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people's lives are more insular. Tend to stay home more. Some of it's economic. I mean, rents are so high, people have less expendable income to go out and drink and eat in restaurants than they used to. When I was 25 or 28 years old, I didn't spend much time at home. You know, I mean, I went out.
Right. Oh, and, I mean,
yeah.
And it wasn't like, and it wasn't like I was going out and getting wasted or anything, but I went out to have a few beers in the neighborhood, maybe shoot some pool, maybe, you know, hang
talk
out with
people,
talk to people.
Yeah. And find out what was going on with people, which you don't, you know, now you get all of their status updates.
Yeah, right.
You know what's going on with people because they won't stop posting what's going on with them. You know what they had for lunch. You know, you don't have to go down to the pub and ask them about it.
And I think that it's it is unfortunate. I think something's being lost that we won't, you know, some people won't lament until they realize it's completely gone. But people under 30 maybe won't even know what they lost because that it was never part of their life the way it was for us. And a bar is, you know, it's a different kind of thing. They don't go necessarily looking for people, you know, familiar faces. They don't know, you know, who's working the bar tonight. Just my buddy's there. I'm going to go and stop in. No, you know, they either gather with a group. We've never had so many, like, parties of 9 or 10 or 12 that come in than we do now. And they don't really interact with anyone else other than their own group. Whereas myself or a buddy of mine, we would go to a bar, sit at the bar, and immediately start talking to the people on either side of us who we didn't know.
Right. It was expected, and now you're almost seeing people think that their privacy is being invaded when someone at a bar goes to talk to them that they don't know. Whereas, you know, there was an expectation that if you were there, you better be open to conversation with strangers because that's what this is all about, you know?
And I've noticed it because I'll still go out now and have a beer or dinner by myself at the bar every now and then because I kind of like doing that. There's something romantic about it in a weird way. And what I've noticed is when I go now, everybody, and sometimes I do because if you can't beat them, join them, their heads are down staring at their phones. You know, where you lose that. All of a sudden there's an excuse not to talk to people. So it almost becomes this like safety net where people aren't interacting as much.
They are not. And you know, people used to, bars were where people met their husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, etc. And I think a lot less of that goes on too,
for sure,
because people have ceded that responsibility to some algorithm.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I met my wife in a bar. That bar's been bulldozed, but the old Cheers pub by Loyola University.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It's a Chipotle now.
There you go. Right. What else do you think, and I think you've written some stuff on this too, like what about the chains? You know, what about the kind of tendency for there to be the mega bars that are owned by investment groups, sort of thing?
When I started going to bars, you know, if I went to a bar that was called Joe's, I was looking for Joe to be there. Mm-hmm. And there were no chain bars. I didn't, you know, the first bar I worked at in 72, 73 was owned by these two guys, and they were there all the time, and they had no, it never really crossed their mind to open a second location. And every bar I worked at back in that era was the same thing. So the bar and the person that owned it were like, they were together. I mean, you when you thought of the bar, you thought of that person. When you thought of that person, you thought of the bar.
Yeah.
Now, the majority of new bars that opened in here and all over the country, they are opened by investment groups, restaurant groups, bar groups, and there is no definable owner.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all, you know, there's a kind of a personality that a bar that's owned by some individual has that is completely lost. And I would like to think that customers would, you know, see the difference and want to go to the place that is owned by an individual. But I don't know that that's necessarily true because a lot of people grew up you know, going to shopping malls and going to chain stores, going to chain bars, going to chain restaurants, and they what they like about those places is that their expectations are always realized. They know, mm-hmm. Exactly, what, I'm going to Olive Garden because I know what Olive Garden is like. And,
yep.
And, that's, you know.
Same reason I don't go there.
Right, the same reason, like, I'm not going to go to Chili's. Yeah. I'm not going to go to a TGI Fridays.
Any place that has flair, right, where yeah. they make their, yeah.
But, the thing is that there are chain beer bars now. And some of them have fantastic selections of beer. Most of them don't have fantastic prices, but... some of the chains have done better than others. Yard House hasn't done that well here, but in some markets they
own Michigan.
They're very big.
Yeah.
And World of Beer, didn't make much of a splash.
Not Yard, what's the one I'm thinking of? The one that opened by Patty's?
Hopcat.
Yeah, they're the ones. They kill it in Michigan. I don't think they're doing great here.
Well, I think they chose an unfortunate location. I think they would have done better in this market if they were anywhere else but that particular space.
So there's been a lot of places in that space.
But I've been in some of their places in other cities, and they're big in college towns. So they just had an investor throw like $27 million at them, and their goal is to have 30 locations open in the next 2 years.
Oh, Jesus.
And then they're just going to grow from there. And, they have like 120 beers on tap.
I know, it's stupid. it is, and we've talked about this before, and I've mentioned the Hop Leaf in it because you guys have what, about 50 different taps?
I have 68 beer,
but you
and
guys
wine taps,
right? But only a certain amount are available in each room, right? I mean, it kind of splits up the choices. It's when you give people all those choices that beers tend to sit,
We stopped at 68, which is a lot, and I am fortunate to be busy enough, and that draft beer is such a huge part of our beverage program that I don't think we ever have tapped a keg that didn't sell in a week or less.
Wow.
And we move through our beers. Now, if
that's
I tap
great.
A 14% Imperial Stout that is in a half barrel, which is something I hate buying, that might take a little longer to sell, but it doesn't matter. But, if I tap a Pilsner or an IPA or a Saison, I'm going to blow through it. The thing with a lot of the chain beer bars is that they try to be all things to all people. I call them, Irish pizza sports bars.
I always call it Planet whatever they are, like Planet Ireland, Planet Pizza, yeah. Planet,
And you walk into those places because
Planet
they're,
beer.
They're all like those industrial chic with like the most TVs you could ever imagine. Like you're like, I don't even know where to look. There's so many TVs. It's crazy.
The interesting thing about those places and the reason that they don't sell through a lot of the craft beer they have is that because they're drawing they're trying to draw the broadest audience possible. They want everybody to go there. And, they want families with kids. They want sports fans. They want college students. They want bargain hunters. They want everybody. So they're still going to sell Miller Lite, Bud Light, Coors Light, Heineken, Beck's, whatever,
Right.
And because of that, naturally, that's what they're, a lot of these bars, their number one seller is still Miller Lite.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. If you give people the opportunity to make a bad choice, they'll make that. they will. That's, and I struggled when we opened here, and I was shitting my pants going, oh my God, we have, 600 seats. How am I going to get, how am I going to survive? I contemplating having Miller Lite.
Like pitchers or that sort of
no,
thing?
No, just, I don't know. I mean, we have it at Patty Long's, just, I don't advertise it, but we have cans of Miller Lite there because it's a neighborhood pub, whatever. I was going to maybe do the same thing here, and I was talking to Tony over at Local Option, because he's got High Life, I'm like, you sell High Life, He's like, well, it's just for me, I'm like, well, you think I should do the, Miller Lite bottles at the new place? And he's like, you know, I'm telling you, Pat, give them the opportunity, they'll make that decision, you know, and it's true. So, you know, we have a lot of people come in here, go, you know, I usually drink Miller Lite. I know you guys don't have it. What do you suggest? And that's how we get them on the train. Or they come in and they say, I drink Blue Moon. What do you got? You know, and if they go to the Hopcat, they probably have Blue Moon. You get the Blue
Moon.
Absolutely. Right. Here, we say, sorry, we've got Omegang Wit or we've got Allagash White or whatever it is, you know. And they don't care and they, you know, think it tastes great because it does taste great.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I agree. Those places are not, you know. Every time I go to these 100 tap places, I just ask the bartender what was tapped this week. Because, and usually he can only name one or two.
Right, and I mean I think that you know we always have one beer on tap that's significantly cheaper than all the rest, and right now for some time we've been using the Surly Helles, which they actually charge less for. It's priced under their other beers, so I can sell for $4 a pint. So if somebody comes in that's a Miller Lite drinker, I can recommend that beer. It's not a big investment for them. I can't imagine they're going to hate it. But if they do hate it, I'm happy to give them their money back and, you know, and we'll call it a day. But we always have some things on tap, like Great Lakes Dortmund or Gold or something like that. That's just an easy drinker or a Metropolitan or a Dovetail. You know, somebody that comes in that's obviously not a craft beer fan, I'm not gonna recommend a Flemish sour ale to them as their first introduction to.
It's not as hard as it used to be. You know, 10 years ago, you know, people got mad at me at Patty Long's because I didn't have Bud Light along with Miller Lite. You know, I was like, look, I'm just going with one of them, okay?
Yeah.
Miller Lite's more popular in Chicago. I'm just going to do that one.
So, they,
you know.
People are brand loyal. Like
they are
like,
brand loyal to those things,
Yeah,
even
crazy.
Though they taste the same. But, you know, now people don't even know we carry Miller Lite. It's not on the beer menu, and they don't expect me to, and they don't even ask for it. They go, you know, I usually drink this. What do you have that's different, you know? And here, they, you know, no one expects us to have a domestic, well, except the Plumbers Union guys. They still complain to me, but it doesn't stop them from having six whatever lager I have on tap, you know? You know, I'd have 12 if you had Miller Lite. Well, I'll just, you know, I'm happy with your six.
I mean, one of the things that I feel is because, you know, we... You know, the Map Room and us used to kind of own our category, and we were often the only place anywhere near that had a lot of the beers that we carried. That's definitely not true anymore. I mean, you can go to a bowling alley, and they've got some pretty good beer. You can go to a Polish bar on Milwaukee Avenue, and they've got some pretty good beer. So that's not what's going to make us different. It's not the draw it used to be. Plus, there's every brewery that's open has a tap room or a full-out brew pub now. And they're all going after my customer, your customer, and we notice that. That's why I think in many ways I'm going back looking at the things that made some of the bars that I worked at back in the 70s and the 80s, what made them successful. Because that their craft beer wasn't a thing then. It was, and I think it's more important now to be a great tavern, a convivial, comfortable place, no matter what your beer list is. I mean, there are, you know, beer bars that have 120 beers on tap and 500 beers in bottles that are really crappy bars. I mean, I don't, you know, even if they have great beer, I don't like the place. On the other hand, I go to some bars that, you know, they only have one or two things that I like, but everybody's having a good time, and you're mixing, and it's convivial, and it's comfortable, and the lighting is cool, and maybe they got some decent food, and there's something magic happening there that I said, you know, I don't really care if their beer list is crappy. This is a good bar. And I think now that's very important, first and foremost, to be... a bar that would have been successful in 1940 in 1970 or any other time. It would be successful. There's something about the place. If it's in a working class area of Birmingham, England, or Copenhagen or whatever, that bar is going to be great, not because of the product, because of the people that go there, its place in the neighborhood, the owner, the personality, the aesthetic. That's become very important. I think it's really important to go back to the roots of what made taverns great before the craft beer thing. And then if you have a great selection of beer, it's a bonus. You know, it's something right. else that we're offering. And if you have really fantastic food, oh my God, another bonus. You
right.
know?
Yeah.
And in our case, I mean, I have a wine list that I'm really, really proud of. And there are people that can't get a glass of beer down their throats for anything that come to us because, wow, they got a great wine list too. And so we offer those things, but that I feel all those things are a bonus. The most important thing is to be a great tavern with a little bit of historical knowledge of what that means. And to, you know, we try to be...
What does that mean to you, Michael?
I think that we are, while we are a destination for people that live outside the neighborhood and sometimes even outside of the United States, our most important customers are our neighbors. And we have done everything possible to integrate ourselves with the 10-block circle around us. As it happens, my wife and I live within walking distance. We live in that neighborhood. We know all of our neighborhood business owners and shopkeepers and all those people. We've given hundreds of thousands of dollars to the neighborhood elementary school.
Yeah, you guys do a great event for the local elementary school.
We have one beer on our draft menu at every day that 100% of that money goes to the school. It raises about $700 or $800 a week.
Wow.
Beyond the events, the special events we do. So this year we'll probably give about $70,000 to the school. So what we support is after-school programs, arts and music for our neighborhood elementary school. We're also involved in some of the other, you know, sort of neighborhood-y charities in the neighborhood. There's an adult literacy program in the neighborhood that we support. We also try to, you know, really get to know the individual people that live in the neighborhood and maybe, you know, get to know a little bit about their lives and, you know, they just got married or they just had a kid or whatever. And I think that that is more important to our long-term success than anything else we do. So, and I think that I had some very interesting conversations a few months ago. When I bought the bar, I didn't own the building. My landlord lived upstairs. She had owned the building for a long time and briefly had owned the bar for a while. She raised two children above the bar. I went and met with these two women who are now like my age, and we went through their picture books of their childhood. Almost all the pictures were in the bar downstairs. And they, the birthday parties, the wakes, the retirement parties, all these kind of things took place. The center of these people's universe was that tavern.
Yeah.
They shared, most of them were Swedes, but not all. They were other ethnic groups, but the most important thing is that they were neighbors. And I think of my own parents. My parents were members of the Knights of Columbus, and the Knights of Columbus had a bar, and that's where we went for the Friday fish fries. My parents...
my dad was a Knight of Columbus.
My parents were on two Knights of Columbus bowling leagues. There was a men's league on Monday and a mixed league on Friday. And then they had a pinochle group that gathered every Saturday. Their whole lives ran was completely revolving around the Knights of Columbus and that bar. That, you know, it was all Catholics, obviously. It was people from our parish and neighborhood parish and the other parishes. And, you know, it was amazing how this thing tied all these people together. And that used to be the case in almost every urban or farm town that had a bar or, you know, maybe one or two bars. I've talked to the older tavern owners of the neighborhood. Most of them, well, they're all dead. But I was lucky that I spent a lot of time with Hans Gotling, who owned what became Hop Leaf for, you know, 35, 40 years. I met Roy Lumberg, whose father, Simon Lumberg, started Simon's.
Yeah.
These people had a really great viewpoint on what the tavern was when in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s that I find invaluable now. It's a knowledge beyond my own experience, and I think suddenly that knowledge is more invaluable than ever because. It'll help me have Hop Leaf have a point of difference from the chain bars.
And yeah,
that's what we need.
Yeah. Sense of community. I think I know when you walk into those corporate bars, at least the impression I get is kind of a cool corporate feel. It's not really a friendly feel. It's kind of
they're not pubs. They're not,
yeah,
you know, pub,
no,
pub is short for public house.
Yeah, and it's like.
And those are not public houses. You can't, you know. You can't have your mail forwarded there.
Yeah, right.
You can't, you're not on a one-on-one basis with the bartender because it changes every time you walk in there. You know, it's a different thing. We're losing it.
One of my customers' father died last week, and I went to Milwaukee to the memorial and funeral because I felt I should.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And you know, this is not going to happen with a customer at the World of Beer.
Right. Some executive flies in from, you know, now I just wanted to briefly touch because I'm a Port Huron guy originally. You kind of started in the Detroit area.
In Detroit.
In Detroit proper.
Yep.
And it sounds like you had kind of a pretty wild, interesting experience when you started there. Anything you want to share kind of with that has transitioned over or compared?
I worked for 10 years in bars in Detroit. I owned a bar in Detroit. My youth in Detroit was, you know, sort of in many ways the last gasp for the city. And, my family were all, you know, all the men worked in factories. I worked for 18 months at Chevrolet Detroit Gear and Axle.
Sure.
There was a whole bar culture around these blue-collar factory workers. And, of course, in that 24-hour, three-shift kind of town, it's another thing that's doesn't exist anymore. Right near the Chevrolet, so the Chevrolet plant I worked at had 11,000 workers, and there were bars right near the gates. And, people would try to, you only had 22 minutes for lunch, so you had to run through this gigantic factory to get there. And the bars used to, they'd have everything set up.
They'd have it laid out.
So you had, this stool is for this guy, and there'd be three shots, two beers, and a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
And the guy would run in and run out, and you didn't pay. So you, on payday, they would have a truck out in front, like a Brinks truck, and you'd cash your check and pay your tab. Or they cashed your check. So, you know, bars, there were bars that would have $100,000 in cash on payroll day. That You know, that is all gone. I mean, it doesn't exist anymore. But I worked in music clubs, punk rock kind of places, and old man bars in Detroit. And
what was the best punk rock show you saw in Detroit in the 70s?
Well, I grew up with the Stooges and the MC5 as sort of the bands that, I mean, these are the bands that sometimes played like high school dances and stuff.
Yeah, started out. Yeah.
My sister, Iggy's first band was called the Iguanas, where he got his name.
Yeah.
The Iguanas played at my sister's high school dance in 1966. I think that I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time with all those kind of bands. And then later on, you know, the things like Negative Approach and those kind of, you know, thrashing punk bands that were big. But we, you know, I worked a bar, I ran a bar that, you know, the Dead Kennedys and the Cramps and the Damned and all those bands played at. And, you know, that was a whole different scene. You will notice that when I came to Chicago, I had no interest in working in music clubs whatsoever. There will never be a band playing at Hopleaf. It's a totally different kind of thing.
It's a different monster, isn't it?
I really admire guys like Joe Shanahan, who somehow, you know, for decades and decades stays on top of this and succeeds economically. Because I think it's in many ways harder, that kind of bar or nightclub is harder even than what we do. But I really enjoyed some of the bars that I worked at. I worked at a place called Cobb's Corner, and I think it's the most important bar I ever worked at for learning how a bar can be a community. And it is no longer there, but, you know, almost nothing in Detroit that was there when I was young is still there. I just soaked everything in. I was young. I benefited by the fact that I turned 18 on January 4th, 1972, and January 1st, 1972, feeling guilty about sending young boys to Vietnam without ever having a beer.
They went to 18.
They went to 18-year-old drinking just in time for me. You know?
That is crazy.
I was able to go to bars when I was in high school legally, and the second I got out of high school, I was able to get a job in a bar. And I actually got a job managing a bar before I was 21. And, that was a unique little slice of time that I was very fortunate to live through. When the drinking age went back up to 21 in Michigan in 1976, I was delighted. I know that people can drink in bars at 14 in places like Belgium and stuff. It just doesn't work here. I don't know if it's the Puritan ethic that we have or something, but the people that were getting into bars when it was 18-year-old with fake ID were 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And American 14-year-olds seem uniquely unprepared for alcohol.
Yeah, that's for sure. It was still 18 in New Orleans when I was 18. And, I had enough of an adventure there that my parents decided I was not going to college in New Orleans. That's how I ended up in Chicago.
Yeah, I would have to sneak across the border for the 19-year-old age. But
oh, in Canada, be, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because Port Huron, you can go over to Sarnia.
Yeah.
What a nightlife town is.
Yeah, Sarnia. Whenever I tell Canadians, just we get a lot on the tours and here in Chicago, and they're like, where are you from? I'm like, oh, right across from Sarnia. They're always like, oh, boy.
It's like the armpit of Canada.
Yeah, right.
Dow Chemical. And
Chemical Valley, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's beautiful, though. Got to come.
To get back on beer a little bit, you know, we've talked about the proliferation of beer bars, and you know how even your local movie theater has, you know, a couple of nice beers on tap, or you know, everyone does. What do you think really sets apart a beer bar nowadays? Since obviously, you know, the list isn't enough, right?
For us, I've decided to sort of go a different direction than a lot of bars, in that while we definitely support our local breweries, I still want to carry not just imports, because we have a lot of Belgian beer. We developed a reputation for it. A lot of bars now think we don't really need to carry those beers anymore, and they're expensive, and you know, and that's not what people want. They want their local beer. Well, we're kind of doubling down on the Belgian thing. And we also...
Because they've really taken a hit, Belgian beers.
Oh, my God. I was in Belgium. I'm actually going to Belgium Saturday. But I was there 2 years ago, and everyone was talking about, like, 30% decline in business in 1 year.
Yeah.
Holy... just because the Americans are crowding out...
The locavore.
Yeah, so much of it... You know, the Americans were also responsible for sort of a resurgence in Belgian beer. So in the 90s and, you know, 2000s, we were the only ones drinking it, in a lot of ways. And they had a big boom. And then, you know, a lot of these breweries expanded and also changed what they were doing to kind of meet the American market as far as kegging their beer and you know, coming out with product that they thought the Americans would like. And then suddenly, just as quickly, the fickle Americans decided they weren't drinking it anymore.
The other thing that we've decided, you know, there were breweries that were really important to our success in 1992, 93, 94. I call them the legacy craft beers. So, you know, Anchor, Sierra Nevada, Dogfish Head, Bell's. Those breweries aren't necessarily hip anymore.
Right.
But I challenge anybody to put an American pale ale with no label on it and put Sierra Nevada next to that, and
it holds up.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And they're making other beers that are really good too, and I'm still going to carry their beer. And it's interesting who buys those beers now, because it is the older customer that we have, somebody that's in their 40s or 50s and increasingly in their 60s, because we have a lot of regulars now who are in that age category. They like the fact that we still have beers like that, that they kind of recognize, and they respect the fact that those breweries make high quality beer that they can rely on. And maybe they are less interested in the extreme beer movement, or you know, somebody's imperial papaya stout. Not saying that those beers are things that we will never carry. We do carry beers like that, but we really, to set ourselves apart now, still carry those beers, or even, you know, carry more of them than we did 5 years ago. And it affects the choices of the newer breweries that we carry too. I like carrying new breweries, but every day somebody comes in with samples of their beer.
Every day. With a new brewery I've never heard of, didn't know it was opening, you know, it's crazy.
It's got to be just madness these days.
It is.
We say no to a lot of people, and I say no to most of them.
Yeah, me too.
It, you know, it's hard to impress me, and I was say, like, is your IPA, you know, well, one, why are you even brewing an IPA? Everybody, it's such a crowded category, but, you know, is it really going to be better than Firestone Walker? Is it really going to be even better than, you know, Anti-Hero, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Probably not, you know?
Yeah. I had the Sun King guy in yesterday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They just started distributing.
In Chicago. Great brewery, great beers. But, you know, I was like, look, I just have to be honest. I don't see where you fit in with, you know, not only what I'm doing, but with Chicago's beer scene. I mean, I'm shocked that you chose this market. This is their first market outside of Indiana. You know, all of these guys come in, these regional breweries, the last couple years, and they all make great beer. You know, they're all big in their home market for a reason, because the beer's good. But they all, you know, and they all make a big splash their first week here. And then, you know, the consumer goes back to the local brewery that they know, who's making, you know, the same style of beer just as well. And there just isn't room. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish there was. I wish I could drink more. But, I drink a lot. I'm doing my part.
You're doing your part.
A lot of people were late to the party and waited, Odell.
You
know, they waited. Why did they wait so long to come here? You know, and by the time they came here, nobody cares.
No.
Father Beer is quite
great beer.
Really good.
It's really good.
Odell's been one of those that kind of impressed me when I was like, okay, these
I visited
guys,
the brewery.
Yeah,
nice, really nice people.
Yeah.
Even Stone fell flat, and that was a little while ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they were too late to the party. Lagunitas was really perfect timing for them, and we were all clamoring for beer before we had 180 freaking breweries, you know, in Chicagoland.
The West Coast, yeah.
And they moved in, and people thought Lagunitas was from Chicago before they had a brewery here. But no one can do that again, you know.
I wonder if there'll ever be another, you know, 50-state national craft beer. I don't.
There isn't one doing well right now, right?
I mean,
Sierra Nevada's happy because they're only down, you know, single-digit percent. They're thrilled about that.
Don't you think that Sierra Nevada and Oscar Blues and New Belgium are having buyer's remorse for opening those new breweries in North Carolina?
They have to be. Although, you know, Oscar Blues is quietly doing well. I guess they probably are in all 50 states now.
Yeah, I think
they do well retail. But you know, do you see them? I'm a rare permanent Oscar Blues handle, because I just love that Old Chub so much, and it goes so well with bacon.
The Old Chub,
it's the ultimate bacon beer, you know.
So good.
I've been called the number one draft account before, and you know, we don't, you know, we do a keg or two a week. It's not.
Look at Shorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For years, because there's a lot of people like us who are ex-Michigan people who, you know, we love our Michigan beer. A lot of them are going, God, I really hope Shorts comes in. When Shorts coming in? Can you get Shorts? But by the time they came in, they made a very brief splash. You can go down some Halstead or Clark Street or Western Avenue and Division Street to bar after bar after bar, and nobody's got Shorts.
No.
And it's,
no one's asking for it either.
Nobody's asking for it. They waited too long, and nobody cares about them anymore. And every style that they make, somebody else makes. You know, there are very few breweries that can set themselves apart. Once in a while, somebody comes in. It'd be interesting to see 6 months from now if you interview me about Oxbow, but I think Oxbow might be one that has some legs. We did an event with them, a rare event. All the beers we tapped sold out that day.
Yeah. I had a very good friend premiere last week, the Second Shift Brewery in out of St. Louis. You know, they don't have a ton of beer to sell up here, you know, and we did five taps. It all sold out. He's my good friend. I'm gonna sell his beer. But he at least has expectations that, you know, hey, I'm going to sell a pallet to Heartland Beverage once a week, and you know, if it moves,
that's what
I'll
sell
them another one. And that's the expectation I think you're going to have in this market. You know, the whole idea that you're going to come in here and have permanent handles at bars is, it's not going to happen.
It's a pipe dream because, you know, and I like breweries that come in with a realistic vision like that. I mean, like Maine Beer Company, you know.
They're only here, I think, because one of the owners, maybe his in-laws are here or something, and he wants to drink his beer when he's here. I don't, you know, it's some weird reason.
My customers like that beer.
Yeah,
that's
good
I can't
beer.
Get it all the time, but, you know, we, you know, they're in the rotation, and they're happy with that. I don't think that they expect anybody to have a permanent main line.
Right.
And that's a reasonable expectation now. But obviously people like Stone, they thought they were going to come here and have like 300 bars having like permanent handles, and good luck with that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we carry their beer sometimes.
Yeah, we too do. Yeah, it's good beer.
And I like it.
Yeah.
But I can't promise anybody that I'm going to have their beer on all the time, and I don't want to listen to anybody offering me a deal if I do, because that's not the way I do business. It's a changed world. There's almost 6,000 breweries in the United States, and the thousands more that exist around the world didn't go away either.
Mm-hmm.
I think that beer could learn a lot from the wine business. No one has even been able to figure out how many wineries there are in the world.
Right.
It's somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million.
Wineries. Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
And
no wonder I'm so confused when I
yeah. I mean,
I assume a lot of those are just labels, right? People who just buy wine and then
more of them are actual
vineyards and everything.
Vineyards. I mean, you know, like a country like Italy and Spain and France have hundreds of thousands of individual family-owned wineries. Now, not all of them export. Some of them only sell to a few restaurants in their own communities, but they're in the mix, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And often those little small ones, some importer will say, how much can you sell for the American market? And they'll say, I can give you 200 cases.
Yeah.
And they'll bring it here. And that business model is becoming more and more similar to the
sure.
beer world. And the wine world has learned to grow and thrive with, you know, over 1 million producers.
Mm-hmm.
Wine does have the advantage of shelf sure. life.
Yes.
That beer does not have.
That's absolutely true. And beer, and a lot of beer that people think has shelf life does
yeah, really
not.
Doesn't, no. Well, no.
And the other scary thing for if you own a brewery is like there was an old joke that somebody told me once. It's like, what's the quickest way if you want to get into the wine business to become a millionaire? It's like to inherit $10 million and lose nine of it by starting your vineyard. I butchered the joke, but that's that's a tough business, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, just like owning a brewery is and.
Only a yeah. brewery, you know, like in if you owned a brewery in 1990, wow! You could make lots of mistakes. You could put out inconsistent, often infected beer,
yeah.
and still succeed. I mean, anybody that's been around as you know as long as I have, I remember some of the unbelievable inconsistencies that, like Bell's in their old day,
yeah.
their kegs.
Notorious.
Their keg cleaning regimen was really, really poor. And so I think the beer that went into the keg was good, but by the time it got to the bars, it was undrinkable. We returned barrel after barrel of really bad infected beer. But we still carried it because when it was good, it was really good, and when it was good, my customers loved it.
And there wasn't that much competition.
No, and now you can't get away with that.
No, no.
You know, you are dead in the water.
You know, I tell all these guys who, you know, ask my advice, I'm opening a brewery, what should I do? I mean, you know, I have a bit of advice, but one of it's like, look, just put it in your business plan now, right now, that you're going to dump the first 10 batches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you don't, great, you have that money. But plan on the first 10 batches not being good enough. And wait until it is good enough before you come out here and try to sell it. Because the second you walk in my door and give me an infected beer, I will never, ever think about putting you on tap again, because I've got too many choices and too many other people that I know are making good beer that I haven't had a chance to put on tap because there's so many of you all, you know? So first impressions now are everything, whereas you're right, yeah, people got away with murder 10, 20 years ago.
You know, one brewery that I probably shouldn't name, did, you know,
don't worry, no one's listening. You can
name they had financial constraints, and in the early days, they sent beer to market that was not ready for prime time at all. And you know, Drew Larson and I, when Drew was still working for me, we kind of sat down with one of the two owners and said, "I know you know how to brew beer. I know that this brewery has a great future, but this beer is not doing you any favor. You know, you cannot send this beer to us, and we're not going to carry your beer until you kind of get these, you nail down these recipes and you get the sanitation correct and everything, because, you know, the customer is the ultimate arbiter. And if I have a customer who orders this beer and then they don't order it again, and they, you know, I go out to clear the table and it's half full, that customers will be hard to win back for that.
It impacts your business, right?
It impacts my business, but it really impacts the brewery. Mm-hmm. Or if they go to a liquor store and they buy a six-pack of infected, bad bottles, how are you going to win those people back?
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, when they're staring at 400 different beers in the liquor store.
And they've got always
money. Why would they ever go back to that one that burned them? Yep. They won't.
You've got to dump it. You must dump beer that is not, you're not really, really proud of.
You know, I mean, that's what happened to Finch, you know, and I don't mind naming their name because they don't even have the same owners anymore, and I'm not sure if they exist anymore. Although they have a building over
online.
They have a building over here with their
name
on.
They didn't show up for the Great Taste of Midwest. They had a booth. They didn't show up.
Oh, my God. They'll never be invited back.
You know how many breweries want to be there that are turned down. They did not show up.
Well, so they did the same thing. They opened up, and during the boom, you know, and everyone was dying for Chicago craft beer, and they sent out a bunch of bad beer, not just to us, but to everyone,
they were obviously opened up by a marketing guy, which they were.
It
wasn't a beer person, it was a marketing person,
was.
And it showed.
Yeah, and they ended up, having to sell. Yeah, sorry, Stuart. No offense. they had to basically sell all of their beer out of state, mm-hmm. because they sullied their name so bad in Chicago. They had to go to places that had never heard of them.
They went to places. They also did best in weak craft beer markets. So they were selling in Alabama, Mississippi.
Yeah, it was a lot down south.
They went south, yep.
Absolutely.
They were selling their beer down there as like Chicago's number one craft beer.
Yeah, and you know, that alone got them up to 30,000 barrels in their best year. Can you? That's a lot of fucking beer, man.
Yeah.
The beer wasn't good.
It wasn't good. that's how the boom was then, you know. And all these guys opening, they have to realize that you know, there isn't going to be another revolution. There isn't going to be another Half Acre in Chicago. I mean, no one's going to get to that size that quickly ever again, you know, in the foreseeable future.
I was going to ask, do you feel pressure to, and you've kind of, I'm sure you kind of answered this already, but do you feel pressure to chase trends? And the one that comes to mind that everybody talks about, of course, is the New England IPA.
Yes, we talked about it last week. Let's get Mike Roper's out. I want to hear what Mike Roper has to say about the Northeast IPA.
Well, you know, one of the great advantages of, I'm a sole owner, I have no investors, I have no partners, is that I can be a taste dictator. And there are certain styles that come around, like the New England IPA, that I don't care for myself. I don't even know why are we making this style of beer? It doesn't make sense to me. So
you hear that, Bruce?
We had a debate the last time, so
I think
you can tell who likes them and who doesn't.
I don't like the style. Now, but it's different. There are other styles that I don't like that I will carry, and I admit that they have legitimacy. I'm not a big smoked malt beer fan, But I realize that this is a style of beer with a long, long history, and that there are examples of it that are definitely worth carrying for my customers who do like them. And I respect the technique, and I respect the breweries that make them.
Unfortunately, I love them. No one buys them. So
really, I'm with you.
Michael's pouring the trend that no one buys.
Right. I agree that it's not a big thing. Although, you know, when they brought back Raftman a few years ago, when Unibrew brought back
Yes.
So
yeah,
we bought it and we blew through it.
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't drink any. I mean, I tried one glass. I said, yeah, I still don't like smoked beer. But
did you guys have the Grisette from Oxbow on at your launch party?
Okay. We did not.
I bought a keg. It's arriving today. I have not tasted it, and they didn't have it at the show.
No.
But it is apparently slightly smoked, so I'm sure I bought the one Oxbow beer that will not sell.
Will not sell. Well, I think one of the reasons we sold through everything is that some of their beers, so they have something called Momoko, which... it has a ridiculous price in a six barrel, and there's no way I could make my margin. And we're doing an event, so I said, "Well, I'll charge $10 a glass for it." If I was really making my margin, I would probably have to charge like $20 or $23 for it. So we're never going to carry that beer again. and I think customers said, "Oh my God, it's only $10." You know, but going back to the New England style beers, I don't really have any respect for that style, and I've tried a few of them, and I said, it's really, why am I supposed to like this? So I suppose I probably have some customers that's their favorite beer, and they'll have to go someplace else to get it, unless I buy one by mistake or something. But
I do, yes, I am a taste dictator here, and I try to only buy what I like. But there are certain things that I can't deny that just aren't in my wheelhouse yet. My customers want. That's one of them, and I don't carry a lot of them, but I will occasionally have a Northeast IPA on tap. The other one is this new American sour beer craze, and everyone thinks I hate sour beer, but I like Belgian beer. We didn't call it sour beer back then. But the Belgians, when they have a product that is on the sour end, they try to make it drinkable by either blending in some fresh beer or adding some fruit or doing whatever. They understand that drinking vinegar is not a pleasant experience, and you don't want another one after you have one. The Americans, we tend to take everything to the extreme, just Absolutely. Like we are on this fucking Northeast IPA thing. But, we want to be beaten over the head with something, and now that sour beer is a thing that people are into, they think the more sour it is, the better it is, And I've had this discussion with people where they, I'm like, I can't drink that. That's undrinkable. They're like, well, taste how sour it is. I'm like, yeah, that's the problem. How much of that can you put down? Well, not very much, but that's,
It's like,
well, then why would you
want
to?
It's like the 100 IBU beer.
We already went through that, and I think we're going, we're going through the sour phase. And I do occasionally have some of these beers that'll take the enamel off your teeth on tap, and they sell. But I'm hoping we dial that back down too, and start to understand the whole art of this beer is in the blending. Anyone can make infected soured beer. It's not that hard. It's really in making it taste good, and getting a product that begs another sip. That is where the talent lies in that style.
Yeah, we've done several events with Lauren Salazar from New Belgium, she's a master blender.
Totally.
She's really good at it, and there are a few people like that. And there's also a difference between like the kettle sour beers and something that spends 2 years in a fooder.
Mm-hmm. There's a big difference.
That's a big difference.
Yeah.
And that's why. I like sour beers. We carry them, but there are some breweries that make sour beers that we never carry because they're just not They have not mastered the technique. They're trying to do the make them sour the quick way, the inexpensive way, and that doesn't please me very much.
Yeah, subtlety has never been a word used to describe the American craft beer revolution. There's nothing subtle about it, but you know, we figure it out eventually, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, it all, you know, it's why right now there's sort of a big movement toward lagers, pilsners, you know, English style bitters and things like that that are actually something I can sit down and drink four or five of, and
yeah, they're designed for that.
And those beers were rejected by American craft brewers for many, many years as too boring, not revolutionary enough, when in fact those beers are a lot harder to make. You know, I use the analogy, it's like a guitar player who's got like all this like fuzz tone and echoplex and all this stuff. You get away with murder, make a lot of mistakes, and doesn't really matter. But like you listen to some like, you know, Nashville like country picker who's got no effects on the guitar and plays smoothly, and you know, it's like clean. That's the difference. I mean, you know, you could make a lot of mistakes on your double imperial stout and nobody'll know. But when you make something as naked as a pilsner, you're going to see immediately, you're going to look at the beer and know it's something's wrong. You're going to smell it and know something's wrong. And you're going to taste it and know something's wrong.
Yeah, I always, you know, when someone's asking for advice because they want to start homebrewing, you know, what's the first beer I should make? I always tell them, well, the two easiest styles in the world to make are Russian Imperial Stouts and Double IPAs. And, you know, start with that, you know, and they can't believe, well, you know, I thought those were the hardest, because, you know, if you look at, you know, Rate Beer and Beer Advocate, the top 100 beers apparently are the easiest beers in the world to make. You know, it hides all of you. You know, the fact is, once you have a 100 IBU beer, you know, there's your taste buds can't discern much, and you can continue to throw hops in there, and they probably won't do anything. You know, so whatever, there's no subtlety, no you know, measured hand or any of the rest of it in any of those beers. You know, Russian Imperial Stout, just pack as much malt, you know, as you can into your mash tun, and you'll be fine. And then throw an absolute fuck ton of hops in there, because no one's going to taste them anyway. And there you go, you're done. You know. So, yeah, it's, you know.
When Beer Advocate's, you know, best beer of the year is a Vienna lager, I'll know that there's been a real change. I don't expect that to be happening anytime soon.
I haven't looked at it in a while, but there is not even a lager. There didn't even used to be a lager with, I think it's a five point scale. Yeah. There wasn't a single lager with five, you know, with a perfect score, with 100 on Beer Advocate. Are you joking? You know, like, first of all, you have to, you know, judge these things based on their style. You know, that's why we have styles, you know. But if something's the best lager you've ever had, guess what? That's fucking five stars, you know.
Absolutely.
Give it five stars. You know, it's the best lager I've ever had. But I'm not much of a lager guy. One star, you know. Like,
Yeah, with the trend following with the New England IPA, I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I mean, it's just crazy to me how people will chase that stuff and wait in lines just for the hot thing. I suppose it's true in any industry, but it drives me crazy, even though I like the style. And I think that's why people rate things in a incorrectly.
Yeah.
Because they're...
Well,
and I find myself, you know, when I sit down at my bar or somebody else's bar and start talking to people, I find myself drinking like a Dovetail or a Pivo Pils a lot more than anything else.
No doubt.
Because it's easy drinking. I usually have things to do the rest of the day. You know, maybe if it's January or something, you know, then I might want a Rochefort, you know, something.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what I drink the most of. To me, that's sort of, those are my lawnmower beers or my everyday drinkers. And I'm glad that more people are making such beers because, you know, I'll probably live longer and get more done.
No question. I call them my recreational beers. I have my work drinking that I have to do, and then my recreational drinking. And it's almost always, you know, it's one of two things. I'm either drinking Alpha King or lager, you know, and that's
good choices.
That's what I do.
I went to there is another bar. There's one other bar on Earth called the Hop Leaf.
Oh yeah,
and it's in Reading, England. It is a 150-year-old tavern, very small, but it's won several awards from the Camera organization. Uh-huh. They have 8 beer engines.
Wow.
Even though the place only seats maybe 50 people. Really, it seats about 35 comfortably. It is the last place left that has any memory of the Simmons Brewery that was in Reading that brewed Hop Leaf Pale Ale. And it is the reason we are called Hop Leaf, because Simmons was a brewery founded in the 1700s. It had the official contract to supply ale to the British fleet. And as the British Empire expanded, so did the fortunes of Simmons. They had a satellite brewery on the island of Malta. My father is Maltese. I've been to Malta many times. Every pub in Malta has a Hop Leaf sign in front of it, which is why I'm the Hop Leaf Bar. But Simmons in Reading went out of business in 1959, and this one tavern was a Simmons Tide pub that kept the name. And so I went in there. I've been there twice. The first time I went there, I went in at 11 o'clock in the morning, and they closed the place. And everyone in the bar was fascinated by my story. They all wanted to buy me a pint, and they sold Imperial pints.
Yeah.
But they had, the beer was 1.9, 2.2, 2.3. The strong beer there was like 4.3.
I mean, right.
And
because they're all day drinking during the day,
just drink and drink and drink, and they were delicious. They were delicious and refreshing, and it was real ale served properly, proper temperature. And I just couldn't believe how much of this I could drink, and, you know, I was still, you know, very conversational, and I was not ready to go home. You know, I had to go to the washroom a lot.
But, that's good for you.
But other than that,
keep it running through the pipes. Yeah, that's good.
But other than that, I mean, I thought, wow, this is a part of the British pub culture, is that the beer, the dominant beer styles, are so drinkable. And, you know, yes, working people can drink these beers and go back to work on the farm or the factory or whatever. They can drive a car and they're not drunk. No wonder, you know, they serve it in Imperial pint, and you can have several of them.
Yeah, work here. People won't do it.
They won't pay the money.
I made a low alcohol stout with Pig Mines Brewery. It's still on tap here at Kaiser Tiger, by the way. The Patty Crack. It's like 3%. And, you know, I'm thinking about taking that off the menu, like just the ABV part off the menu, because I swear people are looking at it and going, no, I'm not doing that. It's only 3%. You know, it just doesn't work here. I don't know why. I spend all my time at these beer festivals trying to find something low alcohol, because I need to keep my wits about me and drink all day and not fall down, you know, and make a fool of myself. And I'm old. So I'm, you know, I spent a lot of time looking for low alcohol beers.
Right, it's price.
It is price.
If you can make a low alcohol beer with at a lower price point, that's craft.
Yeah, but it's not the alcohol that really costs the most money. It's the shipping and the packaging and all the rest of it, and it ends up costing you basically the same as making a 6% beer.
Yeah, but DuPont charges the same for Avril as they do for Saison DuPont. I can't give Avril away.
Right.
On draft or in bottles.
Right.
Because it's just not.
Any low alcohol Belgians are a huge, a really tough sell, and always have been in the U.S.
And the thing, there's this thing that I also think is that because you drink a lower alcohol beer faster, people think not just alcohol related to the dollar that it's spent, but time. You know, I'm going to only spend, if I have an old Rasputin Imperial Stout, I'm going to probably spend 30 minutes with this beer.
Yeah.
If I have a 3% session beer, I might down it in 10 minutes. So I'm spending more money for less time.
Right.
Or the same money for less time.
Right.
And they can't get past that. Whereas I don't really care. I'm just thinking of it's refreshing, it's delicious, and it doesn't make me a blithering idiot.
Which there's always a time for a place to be a blithering idiot as well.
Right.
You know, I'm not discounting that. Well, listen, I could literally sit here and talk to you all day long, Michael.
It was fun.
Class was in session and I took some notes. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Stuart's been pointing at the clock. We are out of time, and I do want you to give a chance to let us know what's going on at the Hop Leaf, and if you want to plug any events or anything.
One thing I would like to maybe come back after my trip to Belgium.
Oh, that would be great.
And talk about it, because the last few trips have been really illuminating, watching the changes that they're making, not just for the American market, but the new markets they're going into. And, there's a little revolution going on there. And interestingly, there's a lot of new breweries there, too.
Hmm. Yes, yes.
Brussels Beer Project, those guys were in town.
Yeah, and aren't a lot of these new breweries kind of emulating American beer in some ways?
They are, but with a twist of their own.
Right. Mm.
I don't think that very many of them are saying, I want to make 100 IBU beers, but they take some of the American beer aesthetic and culture and mix it with theirs. You know, what's happening in America is happening everywhere. So I'd like to do that, come back.
We would love to have you come back and talk about that. Because you are actually like knighted in Belgium for beer, right?
So they have a, the Chevalier de Brasseurs, which is in the Grand Place in Belgium, the Brewers Guild Hall. At one time you could only be a member if you were an owner or a brewmaster of a Belgian brewery. But about 2004, they started knighting people who have had an effect on bringing Belgian beer culture around the world. So in 2006, I went through the ceremony, and I'm actually going to the ceremony this year.
Cool.
I get invited every year.
Yeah.
And so that'll be something.
Do you have a special hat or a sword?
I have a medallion.
Nice. Okay.
And
some bling.
In Brussels, if you wear that medallion around, many bars won't charge you.
Huh.
Oh, so people often ask me to borrow that, and I'm not doing it.
It's the golden ticket.
It is. So as far as stuff coming up, we're doing a series of events. This is our 25th anniversary year. We started at February 15th, and we're going through February 15th because that's how it went. We morphed into Hop Leaf. So we'll be having events all year round. I just say, look at the website. We'll tell you what we're doing. We're trying to honor all the breweries we have long established relationships with, and we're doing a lot of special events. So check out hopleaf.com.
Do you write the Facebook posts?
Yes.
I could tell. I was like, I love the Facebook posts of the Hop Leaf. And
follow the Hop Leaf on Facebook if you're on there, because it's always entertaining.
It's great, and you share a lot of just industry thoughts too, as well as events. And you can almost always tell most businesses are, no offense, Stuart, some marketing person. That
no, we do it.
But you do it.
Yeah. My hey, wife
Stuart,
and I.
Stuart's my marketing guy. Come on now, easy on him.
Sorry, I love Stuart.
Sorry.
No, but it's awesome.
We do it in house, and I'm actually going to start a little blog on there too. and because I need, you know, I need to express myself.
Yeah, yeah.
All the time.
Do it. Do it.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a pleasure, and I can't wait to hear about the exploits in Belgium, which is a country near and dear to my heart as well. And, you know, thank you.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Uh-huh. We will see you all next time. Well, we won't see you because we can't see any. This is freaking a podcast. Yeah, it's like, you know, face for radio. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and tell your friends, Beer Opinions.